the critical role of native species in our ecosystem. News of our natural world is alarming and discouraging. We know that populations of bees and butterflies are crashing, that 3 billion songbirds vanished in the past 50 years, and that climate change and development are diminishing wetlands that are vital to so many species. A new report from the Native Plant Trust and the Nature Conservancy looks at a major way to combat those trends by preserving native species. The report calls for the conservation of 2.3 million acres of land to protect native plants across New England. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss the critical role that native plants play for wildlife habitat and environmental health, as well as what people can do to help protect native species. That's next, but first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. In this country, millions of acres of native habitat has been lost over the years, and it has important consequences for our ecosystem. Today, we're going to talk about why native plants are so critical to the health of wildlife and the environment in Maine and beyond. Joining me, Anna Fialkoff, who is Program Manager with the Wild Seed Project, Joshua Reut, landscape ecologist and conservation scientist with the Nature Conservancy, and Eric Topper, Director of Education with Maine Audubon. We invite your comments and questions. Send us a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page or to Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome, all three of you, to Maine Calling. Thank you so much for being here today. And I know that this topic is going to be of such interest to our listeners. Anna, I'm going to start with you, though, in a real basic definition. What does the term native plant refer to? Are we talking about a plant that would have been here 4 years ago? And when I say here, would it have to have been native to Maine or just to New England or just to this part of the world, North America?
That's a very good question, and I think one that gets confused quite frequently, so I'm happy to address that. I broadly define native plants as to North America as what plants were here pre-European colonization. Because after European colonization, a lot of plant movement started to happen across the different continents. And you can qualify that to whatever scale you'd like. So you can think of a plant as native to New England or native to North America or native to Maine, even native to a smaller geographic area like a 10-mile radius.
So how do we know? How do we know which plants were brought over and which were not? I was, for example, researching a weed that my husband loves in our yard, common mullein, and I saw that it is considered probably to have been brought over by colonists. When the words probably happened, how do we know?
Yeah, we have records from herbarium specimens and botanist records that go back to when Europeans came here. We also do have indigenous knowledge that we can look back on that we don't, I think, enough. And so those are a few of the different ways that we can kind of get a sense of what was native before European colonization or what was here. But we're still actually finding out more information about that with genetic testing these days. And we're finding that there are often subspecies that are native to North America, but then other subspecies of a single individual that are native to Europe or other continents too.
Josh, I understand the Nature Conservancy joined with the Native Plant Trust to issue an important report very recently that supports native plants, and it calls for millions of acres to be protected. Tell me why the report was issued and what it recommends.
Thanks, Jennifer. It's a really neat report, and it's sort of one of those reports that you wonder why it wasn't produced years before, because what it does is it sort of looks back at the past 100 years or so of conservation and really starts to filter out what have we protected so far and what haven't we protected. And you'd think we would have asked that question all along. And yet this really looks at concentrations of rare plants. It looks at landscapes that are more resilient to climate change because of their underlying geology and where they sit in the landscape in terms of elevation. And what it does is it quantifies how much of each habitat type has been protected and how much would need to be protected if we were to reach global conservation goals, those sorts of goals developed by the IUCN Convention on Biological Diversity. So the United States, as well as most countries around the world, have sort of bought into this goal that we should be protecting 30% of the habitat around the planet by the year 2030. So what this report does is sort of translate that to New England. What does that mean for New England? What would be protected ecologically for these rare plant sites? And what would be protected for their surrounding landscapes and habitat types that occur around the state but might not have any representation in an area that's already been protected?
Josh, characterize why this is important, why this matters.
I think it's important for two reasons. One, it lets us know finally what is out there in the landscape and how well we've done protecting it, but also those parts of the landscape, those types of habitats, some special natural communities or rare species that we keep not conserving by the acts that we're doing, by the different types of conservation work that we're doing. And so could we be more proactive? Could we be more focused in our conservation work going forward? So it guides us in the conservation world, the NGOs like we have on this call, but also governments, policymakers, and funders to really start looking at areas that if we protected these efficient units of land, we would actually get a lot of bang for the buck. We would get more natural habitats and more rare plants in some smaller concentrated areas of land and really have representation for the future generations of people and natural communities of the diversity that Maine has, which sort of makes us so special.
Eric Topper, I know that for Maine Audubon, native plants have been a big priority of your organization, getting more native plants out there, not just into big wild conservation areas, but also into individuals' backyards. Why is it so important that regular folks plant native plants in their yards? And how difficult is it to change the mindset of the homeowner in America?
Well, thanks, Jennifer. That's a deep question, a lot there to work with. Maine Audubon is primarily and almost exclusively about conserving Maine's wildlife and wildlife habitat. And so at the very basic level, native plants, whether you grew up learning about food chains or later on you learned about food webs, the plants within those biomes and those ecosystems were either at the beginning, near the beginning, or near the center of that chain or web. So plants are our best kind of building block in that we can sort of manipulate and control to rebuild habitat and restore those connections. So that's what we want people to do at any scale they can. The report that Josh introduced and that we worked on is a really great opportunity of the example of how Maine Audubon works at three different sort of planes. And this report is really useful for all three of those areas. Number one, in our conservation work, this is a report that will guide land conservation and what parcels need to be protected and what parcels we can let go and things like that to get those local efforts to conserve that land. And then once you have that land, how that land is managed. We do a lot of projects to work with professional land managers. This report is a great tool for policymakers and decision makers at all levels, municipal, county, state, et cetera, to guide them and sort of reevaluate where they're gonna do development and things like that based on the maps and the resources provided from the report. And then as an educator, you know, I think just natural history and environmental education is all about helping people revisit, rethink, reevaluate the world immediately around them. And as an educator, we always want those learning experiences to help people form values. And so this is an opportunity for people to go into their front yard or stand at that bus stop at the street corner and gaze on that tree and start thinking about those connections. And a report like this sort of offers the scale, you know, from that individual plant or tree on the corner all the way up to what's happening across Maine and even New England. So it's really exciting to talk on all those planes.
There's been lots of reporting, and we've talked about on Maine Calling several times about what has happened to pollinator species, bees and butterflies, the collapse of so many kinds in so many places, and also, of course, that 3 billion songbirds, we have 3 billion fewer songbirds in North America since in the last 50 years. And Eric, I'm wondering if you could talk to the pace of rebound, that if we were to turn this around, if we were to start getting this right, if more landscapes had native species, how quickly could we see improvement? I'm not saying a complete rebound, but improvement in the trajectory of these really discouraging trends.
I'm tempted to speculate because I'm not a scientist and don't have a reputation to sully, but I don't think anybody really knows. We know this is a huge scale. We know this is going to be require a transformational movement across, you know, across huge swaths of landscape and countryside. And we may be too late on a lot of these connections. We know that, but we have to try everything in the quiver, and we learn more about the species. As Anna said, we're still rediscovering, you know, special plants and important habitats and things like that. And we have to work at whatever scale is possible for us. So if you have a pot on your balcony, start there. If you have 400 acres in the mid-coast, you know, you can start there. But everything in between is on the table.
Sure. And I want to ask both of you the same question. Josh, what do you expect? How quickly can we see improvement? I know it's critical that we see it quickly. Is it too optimistic to think that we could?
Well, I don't think it's too optimistic, but I think we need to be cautious because we know that the planet is changing in unpredictable ways climate-wise. So there are habitats that will change, and there are species that we know are going to blink out. I'm sure people have seen the Maine climate report, which shows things like sugar maple moving further north. What we don't know exactly is what's going to fill those niches, those habitats in that forest, like the chestnut that died out of Maine was filled in by more oaks in many places and beech trees. So we know that forests grow back. Forest ecosystems take very long time to get to the sort of steady state of ups and downs that we expect, in the realm of 300 to 400, 500 years before we get really large logs on the forest floor and things like that. Whereas if there's grasslands and sand plains that we're trying to maintain these dry sort of fire prone habitats, those can respond much faster because those are the types of ecosystems that come in after disturbances in these very dry habitats. And if you look at the report, those are some of the habitats that are the most sort of beleaguered, and where there'd be more of an onus on southern New England states in terms of these dry sand plain habitats. And then there are things which we didn't even mention, like aquatic habitats, which actually, because aquatic ecosystems are used to disturbance, come back extremely quickly. And I know you've talked about dam removals and culvert upgrades on your show before, and how quickly the fish come back in those systems. It's just a matter of fish generations, you know, 4 or 5 years before you get these turnarounds and geometric increases in population. So for the birds, if that's more particular to your question, I think that trajectory is going to be very mixed because of what's happening with the rest of their ranges. Most of our birds migrate. Eric would know more about which ones are in and out, but for all the species, there's habitat well beyond ours and conditions of weather and moisture and pests and pathogens that come in and out of the country. When we talk about native and non-native, we have to include those as well. So it makes it a tricky calculation, Jennifer. And I'm looking forward to your thoughts on recovery time and predictability of it.
And Anna, I just wanted to ask you as well, you know, you've been involved in rewilding projects in which, you know, parcels of land have been allowed to go back to native species. And I'm wondering what happens when that happens, when you take something that used to be a parking lot or a turf grass field and it becomes rewilded. How quickly do you see pollinators return? How quickly do you see birds return?
That's another very good question. Yes, Wild Seed Project's recent launch of our program called the Pledge to Rewild is basically a call to action for the average person to do what Eric just mentioned, to get average people to restore native plants to suburban, urban, and rural areas, to adopt more mindful landscape practices so that the full life cycles of pollinators and other wildlife can be enhanced, and then to join forces with our communities to connect sometimes or often fragmented habitats. So when you're thinking about restoring one individual site, maybe within an urban complex, you often don't see the pollinators come back for quite a while because there's no migration corridors for the pollinators to get from one place to the next. So it could be a number of years before you really start seeing large numbers of bees and butterflies and also birds start to visit a place that's been rewilded in an urban area. But when you start getting more sites, say in one neighborhood with native plants restored to them, then you might develop enough habitat to get those pollinators and other wildlife to move through those places. So connected habitat is extremely important. A lot of New England is in private property. And so I think that the private properties often fragment the habitat. Highways and developed areas do that, but we have kind of the power to bring back habitat in those developed places. It doesn't just have to be those, places of special importance for native plants. It can be just right in your backyard, in a commercial property, or in a public park too.
And let me ask you, Anna, if someone's listening to this program right now and is thinking, what is one thing I can do? What is one thing I can do this summer, maybe on a limited budget, to improve the situation?
Well, I think the first action step number one to rewilding is to plant native trees that support local food webs. So this is drawing upon the work of Doug Tallamy. He's an entomologist at the University of Delaware, and he's done a lot of research on the insect and plant interactions. And that he's found that there's actually certain keystone plants, like trees like willows, oaks, birches, poplars, and elms, and maples, and many more, that are actually highly supportive of a wide variety of insects and large numbers of moth and butterfly caterpillars. And those are especially important because songbirds feed their young primarily on a diet of caterpillars, which is a really important protein-rich source for them. So if you plant a native tree like an oak in your backyard, you can support over 500 species of caterpillars and other insects. So just that act in and of itself is a really powerful act.
All right. Well, we are going to take a quick break. Your comments and questions when we come back. We're talking about preserving native plants and species, why it's so important, and why it's so important not only on the individual level, but as a community and as a state and as a region. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can post a comment to Facebook or Instagram or tweet, or send us an email, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Portland Stage's Ring of Fire, the Johnny Cash musical show presented with Maine State Music Theater, opening August 3rd. Tickets at portlandstage.org.
Workers are expecting better pay as the pandemic wanes. But after the plague of all plagues, back in the 14th century, labor costs went up too and led to the creation of the printing press.
If you've got to pay a scribe a higher wage, then suddenly it makes sense to look for new ways of kind of mass producing books.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Pandemic economies past. Next time on Marketplace.
As the U.S. military withdraws from Afghanistan, the Taliban is sweeping into town after town. In many cases, Afghan forces have surrendered or abandoned their posts.
People at the district village level said, well, why should we be fighting? At the end of the day, we are the ones living with the Taliban.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The new battle lines in Afghanistan this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Why Native Plants Matter. My guest, Josh Reut, who is a landscape ecologist and conservation scientist with the Nature Conservancy. Eric Topper is Maine Audubon's Director of Education. And Anna Fialkoff is Wild Seed Project's Program Manager. You can share your comments or questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page or to Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Maura, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Maura, go ahead.
Hi. So I think one way of saving our native plants is to protect them from the invasive species. Like, I have this oriental bittersweet growing around my house. I already cut it down once, and I'm going to have to go again probably two or three times before it forms the seeds. But I think looking at things like that to, you know, save room for our plants that were already here. Also looking at how the, you know, climate, what can I do to protect the climate, use, you know, less carbon, produce less carbon, and things like that. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your call, Maura. And I'm so interested that you brought up oriental bittersweet. And I think, Eric, I'll turn to you first with this and let others chime in if you want to. I know that there are sort of layers of non-native plants in terms of how invasive they are. Oriental bittersweet being on the top, among the, you know, top 10 that we want to get rid of. Let's talk about the difference between invasive non-native plants and, you know, either beneficial or sort of just benign non-native plants. I'll start with you, Eric.
Sure. They're on a broad scale, Anna has already effectively described sort of the native end. On the opposite end of that scale are plants with varying degrees of invasiveness. That plant, that the idea that what qualifies a plant as invasive is when it starts to outcompete the other plants that it landed in the landscape amongst, and then it becomes a problem and a threat. In the middle of that grand scale are exotic plants, some of our beloved, most beloved landscape plants, our common lilacs, our forsythias, our hydrangeas. These are plants that are native somewhere else and have adapted really well to the kinds of landscapes that horticulture is putting them in right now. You shouldn't, if you have a common lilac, that is not posing a threat to any plants around it. It is going to stay in its spot. It's not going to make babies that take over the wetland nearby. But if you plant a species that's on the state advisory list, you are potentially putting a plant in the landscape, and we've done this all over the place, that is going to go to seed. Those seeds are going to blow around. That Phragmites that looked really well as an ornamental grass in that bank landscape design is going to go to seed, and it's going to blow those seeds all over the landscape. And that's going to land in a place where that Phragmites has no common predators, nothing eats it. And that plant is going to run away with whatever habitat it can find. And so those are the plants we want to target. But I also don't want people to leave here fixated on the 15 worst plants. People should, you know, get rid of the bad plants in defense of the plants you want to manage for. We shouldn't be teaching our students all the invasive plants before they learn any native plants, because we're going to learn about everything that we don't want, and we're going to have a lot of negative energy floating around out there.
Okay. Well, speaking of the state's list, we have Gary Fish with us. He's the state horticulturalist with the Maine Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. Thanks so much for calling in, Gary.
Sure, Jennifer.
Where can someone find the list that Eric's talking about that he doesn't want us to focus on, but he wants us to be aware of?
Well, the list of 33 plants that are not legal to sell or import in the state of Maine is on the state of Maine website at maine.gov/hort.
Okay, great. Well, Yeah, we'll post a link to that. I understand that your own garden is filled with native plants. Tell us the story of it. When did you start this project, and what are you growing?
So I have just a little postage stamp lot in Augusta in the middle of the city, and it had a lot of plants that were there originally that I took them all out. They were your typical yews and things like that. And slowly I've been adding as many native plants as I can. I've actually bought them from Maine Audubon as well as from Wild Seed, so I appreciate their making those available. And I've planted everything from service berry tree down to, you know, lots of different types of milkweed and a lot of other flowering plants that will give flowers year-round. And I have surrounding me postage stamp lawns that don't really have anything on them. You can come to my side of the fence and see all kinds of birds and bees and butterflies, and you look over the fence on the other side and there's nothing there. So I think that it's really important that, you know, people embrace the idea of using native plants, and I would encourage them to talk to their local plant supplier to urge them to start growing and providing more native plants. It's not easy for them to transition because they're used to either bringing in plants from other parts of the country where they grow faster, or they're starting plugs of plants that are, you know, not usually native plants. And if they're really going to grow true natives that are from this area, they may have to do that from seed, and it's a lot more work, and it doesn't grow quite as fast, and it's a major change for them. But if we all start requesting native plants, then more of them will bring more of them on.
All right. So we've asked Anna one thing that we could do, and she said plant some native plants. And one thing that you say is go to your local nursery and beg for some more native plants. I know that they're hard to find. I've been trying to find that orange, beautiful butterfly. Is it called butterfly weed? And I have had a hard time finding that. Eric, do you have that at Audubon, by the way?
Available this minute.
It is. Okay. I'm sending my husband over. But Gary, let me ask you a question that's come in from a listener, because I think you might be the best of the four of you to answer this. This is from Deborah. She writes, I've been seeing large areas of invasive plants along highways this year, including at least one road labeled a scenic byway. Any ideas on how to encourage towns in the state to incentivize the removal of invasives and planting native plants? I know that the Maine Department of Transportation has had a long history of trying to identify areas for native plants, but clearly we still see a lot of invasives along highways. What do you think needs to happen, Gary?
Understand the relative problems and risks that are posed by these invasive plants. And the other thing is just it's a matter of resources. The resources are not there to either assist the towns to do the control that needs to be done and then to replace those plants. Because if you don't, if you just go out and remove all kinds of invasive plants, normally what happens is you just get new invasive plants back. You really have to have a plan, and you have to be able to reestablish something there, or else it just continues to be a problem. And that takes a lot of time and resources, and towns are already strapped, and so is state government. And I don't really know, other than for more people to learn about the problems and demand, you know, help, then, you know, possibly the help will come. There are programs available through the Maine Natural Areas Program. Nancy Olmstead does provide assistance to towns as well as landowners in certain ways. And so that's one way to get some help. And certainly us at the horticulture program and the department are, you know, very willing to provide guidance and help and getting some of these plants under control.
Anna.
Yes, and I also just want to add in that Wild Seed Project teamed up with Maine DEP, I believe, in 2015, and we created a Maine roadside guide to advise the Maine Department of Transportation to restore native plants to roadsides, and this might involve changing the mowing regimen, not mowing during the growing season if possible, and then maybe even retraining road crews to target mowing and removal of invasive plants instead of mowing during the growing season, the majority of the roadside. And that way, the native plants will be able to kind of have a competitive advantage, and you don't even have to really do a whole lot just tweak some of the management practices. But then also in the guide, there's some specific directions for collecting seed from native plants on the roadsides and helping repopulate areas that are depleted of native plants.
Well, Gary, before we let you go, what's your favorite? What would you recommend somebody start with in their own garden?
Well, I think that I really like my swamp milkweed. It's very easy to grow, and it comes up very tall. It has beautiful pink flowers, and it attracts many different types of pollinators to the flowers, as well as hopefully some beautiful butterflies to the leaves. And, you know, I haven't gotten any monarchs yet, but I'm sure they'll show up at some point.
Well, Gary Fish, thank you so much for calling in. He's the state horticulturalist with the Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. Going to another question from a listener, we'll go to Julie on Peaks Island. Hi, Julie, go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to say that because I keep my yard in half for the 35 years I've lived out here, relatively wild. I like to think of it as a deer preserve. I do mow around the house to prevent fire danger, but I think the state could help us a lot. We have a rainwater tax, and I think that they should make some sort of allowance for people who naturalize their properties in a smart way, like the way you're recommending, and give them that credit on that rainwater absorbency type use of the land, rather than just focusing on the negative, how many driveways have you paved over, what's the size of your roof on your house. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Julie, thank you so much. I see some nodding among our guests, and none of you are in the position of making state policy, but Eric, you agree that it would be a good idea.
I think just anything that is going to incentivize and switch around the sort of valuing structures that we use in our landscapes, and especially our developed landscapes, where, you know, people, we placed all these other landscape needs, for example, fire safety has to trump wildlife habitat next to our houses, and it will always be that case. But there are other places where, A, we should be making the switch over and just doing what Anna and Wild Seed Project tell us to do where we can. But then I think there is a role for government at all levels to figure out ways to incentivize people signing on to particular things. And then particularly for developers to incorporate native plants and other, you know, the caller talked about rainwater, you know, runoff prevention, things like that, into that stuff. There's got to be ways to incentivize that. And I know Josh has more to say about.
Yeah, well, that's a great point. There are places in the world where there are incentives and disincentives for dealing with stormwater. And it made me also realize sort of the carbon consequences of having a mowed lawn versus having a wild lawn. And not only are you not burning gasoline in your lawnmower or charging your batteries for your electric lawnmower like we do, which still needs energy from some source, but it's also storing more carbon when you've got these wild gardens, when you've got diverse native plants and forests, of course. If you can keep more land in forests not only store all that carbon in their needles and leaves and their stems, but also force it into the ground and all the life that the ecosystems underground harbor. So it's really, it does so much for the environment when we focus on these natural habitats and protecting them and trying to restore them or rewild them.
Anna.
Yes, I agree. I think we can also think about, I think, the supply of native plants. I'd love to direct the conversation a little bit that way, because one of the reasons Wild Seed Project was started 7 years ago by our founder, Heather McCargo, was because she saw that there was a really great need for both education about native plants in the state of Maine, as well as supply for native plants. And in the last number of years, the supply has been going up. There's a number of small native plant nurseries, and as well as the larger nurseries like Pearson's are, you know, having lines of native plants. There's also plant sales like the Maine Audubon plant sale, and then a Wild Seed Project has a native plant sale in at the end of the season in September, a great time for planting. But I also really think that, you know, there's a even more supply needed as the demand increases and people become more educated about native plants. So one thing that Wild Seed Project does is actually we sell native seeds. And this has a twofold purpose. This is both to kind of empower people to grow their own. It's a real grassroots initiative to grow their own seeds or plants from native seeds. And then also that if you grow plants from seeds, which is not commonly done in the nursery industry, you preserve the genetic diversity of a particular species that way. And that's essential because when you preserve that genetic diversity, then the generations of that plant have the ability to adapt to things like climate stressors, like flooding and drought and extremes of temperature, more readily than a plant that's been cloned from a nursery. So there's a couple of different things we want to look at when we're looking to buy native plants, but overall we just want to increase the supply in nurseries and really make sure that plants are grown from seed when possible and grown without pesticides, which can live in the plant tissue for a number of years and be detrimental to pollinators too. So I encourage people to go on the Wild Seed Project website and look up where to buy native plants, because we have a whole list of places that you can get plants in Maine and beyond.
All right. Well, we do need to take another quick break talking about native plants on Maine Calling. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. The phone number 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from BCM Environmental and Land Law, focused on Northern New England environmental law and land issues, bcmenvirolaw.com, and Fallbrook Woods, a Maine-owned assisted living community in Portland, supporting the unique needs and individual styles of those with memory impairment, fallbrookwoods.com.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Blues great Bobby Rush toured for decades before he had his first hit record. He was 83 when he won his first Grammy. The long wait for recognition wasn't for lack of talent.
I'm not going to kiss they butt on that term. Now, I didn't say I wasn't going to kiss no butt, but it's going to be on my turn.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Been down in Mississippi and a show. Maine's Political Pulse is a weekly discussion on the politics here at home with Chief Political Correspondent and State House Bureau Chief Steve Missler. The Pulse can be heard on Fridays during All Things Considered and is also available as a weekly podcast and newsletter at mainepublic.org. You can have the Political Pulse newsletter delivered straight to your inbox on Friday mornings by subscribing at mainepublic.org/pulse.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You are listening to Maine Calling, and we are talking about native plants and how you can help protect them. Joining us, Eric Topper with Maine Audubon, Anna Fialkoff with the Wild Seed Project, and Josh Reut with the Nature Conservancy. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. If you're quick, you can tweet at Maine Calling or post on our Facebook page or to Instagram. I'm going to go to a very simple question, an email from Allison. Can you tell me if rugosa roses are indigenous to Maine? I have a feeling Allison's going to get some bad news. Who wants to take it? Eric?
Sure. Rosa rugosa is not native to Maine. There are wonderful, wonderful examples of species of rosa native to Maine. Virginiana is a favorite of mine. There are also some other that will grow in a lot of diverse landscapes. There are other varieties as well. I'm sure you can find at the Maine Audubon plant sale, as well as the Wild Seed Project plant sale as well. But Rosa rugosa
Right. Not native, but also not one of those that you would advocate people go tear all out of their yard, right? I see Josh, you nodding there.
Yeah, it's not to the point that Eric was making earlier, and you, as actually everyone was making. You know, there are those plants that completely take over habitats and destroy, really change them from what they were, and exclude other native plants and all that rich diversity that's so important. And Rosa rugosa mostly stays put. I imagine there are habitats where it does creep away, but we do have so many great native roses. They're in my backfield. When I let it grow up, the meadow sweet and the pasture rose comes in, and it's beautifully scented and a really lovely flower. So I feel like we can edge away from those, but I wouldn't get the backhoe out just yet.
An email from Jim. Yeah, go ahead, Anna. Go ahead.
Sorry about that. I might add in just a few other really lovely native species of roses that you could potentially plant instead, just that because they would have a little bit more appeal to wildlife. So there's the Carolina rose, which actually grows in sand dunes and is really great for urban sites. You can plant it in a health strip. That's that space between the sidewalk and the road. That's a really tough spot to plant and is often very dry or gets inundated with water or is, just salted and sanded. So it's a really hard spot to find for planting. So Carolina rose, as Eric mentioned, the Virginia rose that loves wet spots, and then swamp rose as well that loves wet spots. Those are all beautiful flowering, proliferous flowers. They're really lovely plants to plant instead if you have the opportunity. And then to avoid or just take note of the invasive rose, the multiflora rose. It has tiny white flowers. It's extremely common. That's why it's called invasive. They're ubiquitous in our landscapes. And that's one that you could definitely take out when you see it in the landscape.
All right, I'm going to go to a question here from Raya on Facebook. What resources do they recommend for us to learn about faunal associations of native plants? We all know about monarch and the milkweed, but there are so many examples. It is fascinating to learn what specific moth or butterfly or insect relies on a particular species of plant to complete their life cycle. The silver-spotted skipper on hog peanut is a less known example. Eric?
Yeah, so Anna mentioned earlier Doug Tallamy, who did a lot of the research that really started this kind of movement in developed landscapes in particular. And he, as an entomologist, he studies the connections between insects and their host plants. And so National Wildlife Federation, nwf.org/plant finder, I think, is where Doug Tallamy's research all lives. You can enter your zip code there and you will pull up, based on historical record, all of the genera, the genus of plants. They only go that deep. They don't go to the species level. So you can find the genus of plants and the historic records associated with that genus in that county. And so you can find out historically when this plant has grown in this landscape. There are records associated with these butterflies and these moths laying eggs and their caterpillars eating those leaves. And so again, if you type up any zip code in Maine and you look up milkweed, you'll see that milkweed is historically a host plant for monarch butterflies and about six other species of butterflies in Maine. And so to Anna's earlier point there, that's where you can get that dashboard top to bottom. Here's the genus that hosts the biggest number of species in most counties in Maine. That's willow or others. And then all the way down through in order.
Go ahead, Anna.
Yeah, and I just want to add to that, so what you plant is just as important as how you manage your plantings to support that wildlife. So for example, the Baltimore checker spot butterfly is in decline, especially in New England. And one of its main host plants is the white turtlehead, which, you know, the white turtlehead flowers are really important for bumblebees as well. But they lay their eggs, the Baltimore checker spot lays their eggs on the leaves of the white turtlehead. and they actually, their caterpillars eat the foliage for not just one, but two growing seasons. So they eat the foliage, they go down to the base of the plant and overwinter in the leaf litter. And then they come back up and finish, you know, storing up that energy until they can pupate and become butterflies and start the cycle over again the following growing season. So what that indicates is that there's actually a number of butterflies and moths that at some point in their lives spend time in the leaf litter. And so if you're blowing away that leaf litter, then you're taking away the opportunity for that pollinator or other wildlife to complete their life cycles. And so they can't keep repopulating themselves throughout the years. So that's another essential piece of that, is not just the particular host plants, which are really important, but also, you know, the mowing and blowing that we do in our landscapes contribute to habitat loss as well.
And Eric, I'm going to ask if you'll send us the link to the book that you gave us, and so we can put that on our Facebook page and on our webpage. We're going to go to Maggie calling from York Beach. Hi, Maggie, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. About 30 years ago, my dad planted a privet fence and privets around. I know they're an invasive species. They're from Asia. And I'm always trimming them and pulling out stuff because they spread. However, I have tons of monarchs, tons of bees who particularly like this trait. I wouldn't recommend them because they do spread. My second comment is I invested in a Fiskar push lawnmower out of a company, I think it's out of Switzerland, who makes very expensive hair cutting scissors. This one you push, it self sharpens. It is so amazing. I don't need to use my gas lawnmower or an electric one. I just feel so good about using it all the time. It takes a little more time, but it's so easy to push. It does a tremendous job. And I know those old, you know, Scott push lawnmowers or nobody buys them anymore, but boy, has this been just a wonderful thing. So anyway.
Well, Maggie, thank you so much for the tip. And Anna, let me ask you though about this, the privet, because it's one of many plants that people will see that we know is not native, but we also see butterflies and bees around them.
Right. Yeah, so, you know, privet, Japanese barberry, burning bush, they all are commonly planted still in people's landscapes, yet they are invasive species. And people plant them for different reasons, as hedges, for fall color, and they may host some wildlife. It doesn't mean that they're not valuable whatsoever. I know that multiflora rose is important because it has very dense kind of foliage and branching, and then it can kind of provide some protection. But if you look at the native shrubs that you could replace those shrubs with, they would probably provide tenfold the amount of wildlife value. So that's one of aspect of, you know, not planting or encouraging those invasive plants in your landscapes, but also just that, you know, on the large scale, the privet, the burning bush, the Japanese barberry are going to reseed into the broader landscape. And you might not notice at first, but you'll see, if once you get an eye for it, if you start looking around, you can see their seedlings and their populations just exploding in the surrounding landscape. So that's one very big reason for not planting those, and maybe thinking about replacing those burning bushes and privets, those hedges, with native plants like inkberry holly or other dense shrubs that can provide like the same landscape function.
We'll go to Susan calling from Camden. Susan, we're getting tight on time, so if you could be quick, that'd be great. Susan, go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead. And if you could be quick, that'd be great.
Okay. I wanted to recommend a book. It's by William Cronon, and that's Cronon. He was a forestry professor, I think, at Yale. And he wrote this wonderful book. This book is the thing that made me interested in ecology. It's called Changes in the Land, and it's about the changes in the New England landscape since European colonization. And I would really suggest that people pick that up and read it. It's incredibly informative.
Great. So Susan's suggestion, Changes in the Land by William Cronin. We have an email here from Mary. When grubs killed a hula hoop-sized patch of lawn a few years ago, we did not replant grass, but let it go wild. Now there's milkweed, multiple aster species, meadow sweet, serviceberry, evening primrose, etc., and lots of bugs and birds. So interesting to hear such a great description. Hula hoop size section, a very small section, and without, it sounds like, even any effort, Mary has had native species come back. Is that, Josh, I'll turn to you, is that to be expected, or is that, was she lucky?
I think there's some luck involved. It probably depends on what was around in the landscape, but the more that we can encourage that type of diversity, the better it'll be for the health of not only the plants that she's seeing there and the diversity of flowers at different times of the year, but there probably won't be that grub problem underneath that might have caused the die-off of the grass to begin with. But I think this is a concept that Anna brought up with the different life stages of different species requiring different plants at different times, different habitats. And the more we can diversify our habitats overall, the healthier our landscapes are going to be, and the better they'll survive the pests and things that come into our yards and our woods over time. So really looking at diverse places, protecting them in as big a chunks as possible is really going to help keep Maine with more native species longer.
I'm going to try to squeeze in one more question. Susan in Stonington, if you could be quick, that would be great.
Okay, thanks very much. I have started some oak trees from local acorns, and they're doing quite well. But my concern is that I have some mature oaks that are, you know, a 50-foot tall tree that are being decimated by a brown-tailed moth caterpillar. And I'm wondering what, if any, hope I have for either the new oak trees or the old ones.
Oh, boy, Susan. Thanks for calling. And, Eric, this is a big issue, not just the brown-tailed moth, but also the emerald ash borer and hemlock woolly adelgid. We have some real threats.
Yeah, the invasive pest is a great topic for a whole nother show, that are going to eat the invasive. They won't eat the invasive plants, but they'll eat everything else. But it's definitely a problem in a lot of communities, and our oaks are suffering. Give them a chance. They're going to come back. We're watching our beloved oak in Portland. But yeah, it's a real problem.
That's right. The candelabra tree in Deering Oaks Park. Susan, thank you so much for calling. And thank you to our guests today. Anna Fialkoff is the program manager with the Wild Seed Project. Joshua Reut, a landscape ecologist and conservation scientist with the Nature Conservancy. And Eric Topper, director of education with Maine Audubon. Our sound engineer was KG Akimoladun. And we had production help from John Keimel, Jonathan Smith, and Cindy Hahn. Production help from John Keimel, Jonathan Smith, and Cindy Hahn produced Maine Calling. Tomorrow on the program, we will learn about the Dark Skies Movement and why Maine has become a prime destination. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.